Good afternoon, everyone. I call the Senate Health and Social Services Committee to order at 3:31 p.m. Thursday, March 9th. We're meeting room 205 at the Butrovich. Please remember to silence your cell phones as a courtesy. Committee members present today are Senator Tobin, Vice Chair Kaufman, Senator Geisel, and Senator Dunbar, and myself, Senator Wilson. We do have a quorum to conduct business today. We do have a few items on our schedule, but first, Senate Bill 59, Runaways, Department of Families and Community Services, Department of Health, Duties, Licenses, and Info has been pulled from the agenda, request from the sponsor of the bill, and that leaves three items on our agenda. First, we have Senate Bill 51, which we have the Controlled Substance Database, Exempt Veterinarian, sponsored by Senator Tobin. We have Senator Tobin's staff at the table and Senator Tobin here. We took an overview of this bill on February 28th. And a sexual analysis and took invited and public testimony at that time. Are there any final questions from the bill sponsor? Does the bill sponsor have any comments or remarks they would like to make at this time?
Through the chair, this is Trevor Bailey, staff to Senator Tobin. I just want to say thank you for considering the bill and I urge your support.
Thank you. All right. We did not receive any amendments to the bill. Are there any amendments at this time? Seeing none, is there a motion? Senator Kaufman.
I have a motion. I move Senate Bill 51, which is 33-LS0339/A from committee with individual recommendations and attached to zero fiscal note.
Is there objection? Seeing or hearing none, Senate Bill 51 moves from committee with individual recommendations. We'll take a brief at ease and we'll then move on to Senate Bill 53. Good afternoon. Welcome back. Our next item of business is Senate Bill 53, the 5-year involuntary commitment sponsored by Senator Klayman, who's here at the table. We heard an overview of the sexual analysis and we took invited in public testimony on February 21st. We had a second hearing on the bill on March 2nd, where the bill sponsor discussed some changes and answered additional questions this afternoon. I believe we have a committee substitute before us. For consideration at this time, is there a motion to adopt the CS as our working document? Senator Kaufman.
I have a motion. I move to adopt work draft 33-LS0172/S as our working document.
Right, and I'll object for purposes of discussion. Senator Klayman and Ms. Potter, if you guys want to talk a little bit about the CS, and everyone should have the CS hopefully in their packets.
For the record, this is Emma Potter, staff to Senator Klayman. I am going to walk through the explanation of changes for the new version S of Senate Bill 53. Section 1 amends subsection A of AS 1247-070 to reduce the number of qualified psychiatrists or forensic psychologists from two to one for evaluation under the affirmative defense of insanity. And this section removes the requirement that the forensic psychologist is certified by the American Board of Forensic Psychology. Section 2 amends subsection B of AS 1247-100 by adding the requirement that the motion for judicial determination of competency is a written motion. Section 3 adds a new subsection I to AS 1247-100, which states that the court may release a defendant on bail to be examined at an outpatient clinic or other facility under AS 1230. Section 3 also adds a new subsection J to AS 1247-100, which states that when a qualified psychiatrist or psychologist is conducting an examination for competency under B of this section, they may at the same time evaluate the defendant to determine whether the defendant meets the standards for involuntary commitment. Section 4 amends subsection B of AS 1247-110 to increase the maximum total time for competency restoration hold from 1 year to 2 years when the defendant is charged with a crime involving force against a person and the court finds that the defendant presents a substantial danger to physical injury to the two other persons and that there is a substantial probability that the defendant will regain competency. This change is reflected by amending 6 months to 18 months. Section 5 adds a new subsection F to AS 1247-110, which states that the court may release a defendant on bail for further evaluation and treatment at an outpatient clinic or other facility under AS 1230. Section 5 adds a new subsection G to AS 1247-110, which requires that the prosecutor shall provide the court's findings to the division of the Department of Law that has the responsibility for civil cases within 24 hours of the court's ruling, and adds the requirement that the Department of Law must file the petition for involuntary commitment within 72 hours of the dismissal of charges. Section 5 adds a new subsection H to AS 1247-110, which states that when the court dismisses the charges, the defendant may not be discharged until 72 hours after the charges are dismissed. Section 6 adds a new subsections G and H to AS 4730-725, which create notification provisions for the victim of the dismissed criminal case. Subsection G states that the victim shall be notified of the time and place of a civil commitment hearing, of the length of time for which the respondent is committed, and findings of fact made by the court, and when the respondent is discharged from commitment. Subsection H states that subsection G does not give the victim in a dismissed criminal case access to record or information that is confidential under AS 4730-845. Section 7 amends subsection A of the new section created by the bill in AS 4730-771 by removing the word repeated from the history of felony offenses requirement. The CS also makes conforming changes to add the crime of arson to the legislation. Section 9 amends subsection C by removing the word repeated from the history of felony offenses requirement, similar to section C7 of the bill. The CS removes language that is or is committed as a result of being found incompetent to stand trial under AS 1247-100 and 1247-110 for a felony offense against the person. The CS also makes conforming changes to add the crime of arson to the legislation in Section 9. Section 11 creates a new section of the bill. This section is an indirect court rule change to conform with the added requirement of the written motion by attorneys requesting competency evaluation in AS 1247-100 and Section 2 of the legislation. And finally, Section 12 creates a new section of the bill which adds conditional effect language based on the indirect court rule change.
Thank you. Before we go to questions, just letting committee members know, we have four folks from the Department of Law, three in the room, one on the phone, and we see we also have a representative from the Alaska court system, and on the phone, a representative from our Alaska Psychiatric Institute is also on the phone for members of the committee. Are there committee questions? Bill sponsor or any other representatives in the room? Senator Dunbar.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question for the head of API. So I have heard from a number of folks about this bill since it was introduced that, you know, essentially API doesn't really have the capacity to do this. If there is something like a 150-day wait list right now, and I'm wondering if you could speak to that. And also, the zero fiscal note, I find it a little bit surprising. So could you please speak to both those questions?
And Dr. Christy Becker, the Chief Clinical Services from Alaska Psychiatric Institute, did you hear Senator Dunbar's question?
Yes, for the record, this is Dr. Christy Becker from the Alaska Psychiatric Institute. I am the chief clinical officer of the hospital, and I am a psychologist, just to clarify. Through the chair, I did hear Senator Dunbar's question, and I will do my best to respond. Currently, the Alaska Psychiatric Institute has a 10-bed competency restoration unit. We are in the process of attempting to open additional avenues to competency restoration. Those include a jail-based competency restoration program that we hope to have up and running at the beginning of the fiscal year, and an outpatient competency restoration program for low-level nonviolent misdemeanors that we also hope to have open sometime this summer or fall. That being said, with only 10 beds, which is the lowest per capita bed number for any competency restoration program in the United States, we do have incredibly limited capacity and lengthy wait lists. We've made great strides to get our evaluations done in a timely fashion so that on the front end, these defendants are evaluated and seen in court quickly, but this has resulted in a wait list on the back end where the defendants are often waiting in jail for placement in a bed for competency restoration. And with only 10 beds available, certainly that does present some complexity in terms of what longer-term commitment periods might look like for our wait list, and I would imagine that it would increase that burden. So that is part one of your question, Senator Dunbar, and through the chair. In regard to part two of your question about the zero fiscal note, my understanding, and I will acknowledge I am not a finance person when I say this, is that it's a zero fiscal note at this time because it doesn't actually change the cost of caring for patients in our facility because those 10 beds are always full, regardless of who is or is not on that wait list. Those 10 beds have been full, to my knowledge, for the 10 years I've worked here in the state. So I don't have any additional information regarding the fiscal note. I can tell you that, you know, program development and additional staffing does cost money, but I don't have a clear understanding of how that's to be reflected in our fiscal note. Thank you.
Yeah, just very briefly, thank you, Mr. Chair. So, I mean, I assume the jail-based and outpatient competency restoration programs are in the hope that you can not have those 10 beds always full. But if that's the case, then this bill might fill them up after all, right? And those jail-based and outpatient programs presumably aren't free. So I guess I'm still puzzled by the zero fiscal note. And I don't know if...
Through the chair, Senator Dunbar. Yes, I do understand. And those two do have new notes and do have fiscal requests that I believe are in front of the legislature and the Senate in a different way, and I apologize for not fully understanding this portion of the process, but I do know that there are budgetary requests being made to fund those programs and that we have some funding through the Mental Health Trust to stand those programs up. So they are not zero-cost programs, and they have required additional staffing and hiring and program development. As to whether or not those programs will ever free up those 10 beds, my answer to you at this time, based on what I understand about the wait list and the numbers, escalating numbers of competency evaluations and restoration orders the state has received, is that they will not. Most likely what will occur is that the 10 beds here at API will eventually be utilized for the most clinically complex and difficult to manage patients who have the highest psychiatric needs. The jail-based beds will be utilized to manage those defenders falling sort of in the middle of the spectrum, and then the outpatient restoration program will have very clear inclusion and exclusion criteria, will only accept misdemeanors whose crimes do not involve force against the person, and will be utilized to manage the lowest level offenders in the least restrictive environment. Thank you.
Excellent. Thank you for that very detailed answer, Dr. Becker. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. I guess going along with that question and well, first, Senator Martin, yeah, that we did receive that request, and they did talk about the additional beds in our finance subcommittee for the Department of Health. But I guess my question might be for Stephen Bookman for the Department of Law.
Mr. Chair?
Oh,
I'm not really actually trying to, well, I actually don't think Dr. Becker really answered the question raised by the fiscal note, because the fiscal note has nothing to do with competency and incompetency in the 10 incompetency restoration beds. The fiscal note is specific to the capacity for people who are placed in involuntary commitment. And involuntary commitment is the Title 47 procedure. And I think the answer is sort of similar on the fiscal note, but the fiscal note says nothing about incompetency evaluations. The fiscal note is entirely about the bed capacity at API. And what it says is their capacity is 80 beds and they're basically full. And so they'll still be full and they'll still have an obligation to hold the people that have to be involuntary committed for a long time. And it raises questions about whether the longer period might cause more demand on the beds, but those beds may still be in the same demand with people that are serially being held for 6-month holds under the current structure. So I'm not trying to disagree with the good doctor, but I don't think the fiscal note has anything to do with the incompetency evaluations.
Right. And I think that part of that's going to be the same individuals that are doing the competency base versus commitments are going to be the same individuals that will be doing those evaluations. I think that's part of that is too, is for some of the additional costs. But while I have Mr. Bookman on the phone here, what Dr. Becker stated upon the jail-based programs, do you feel that that might cause an issue with the state's Disability Law Center settlement in terms of continuing to have false imprisonment when folks that could go to API or community-based centers are still within those institutions?
Yes, this is Stephen Bookman, Assistant Attorney General, through the chair, I guess it's you. I don't. The Disability Law Center case was about people who had no criminal charges whatsoever and were in a jail because they had to be somewhere safe while they were waiting, getting to API or another hospital. The in-jail competency restoration program instead would be for people who were already in jail because of a criminal case. They hadn't been granted bail, and instead of them, you know, being in jail and then waiting to get to API for treatment, they could treatment or education, they could be provided that treatment and education while in jail. So I think that's a separate issue. The Disability Law Center case was about the purely civil patients, and these would be about the people who are criminal defendants and who there isn't a civil case on.
Thank you, and I know that's helpful. Yes, thank you, Mr. Bookman. I know that wasn't directly related to your bill, but I had to take that opportunity to get that answer. Any further conversation on Senate Bill 53? Senator Tobin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think this question is for the bill sponsor. I apologize, as I wasn't here to ask this previously. Why was arson included?
Arson was included after consultation with the Attorney General's office. And there, because particularly first degree arson involves, the first degree arson involves that a person is put at risk as a result of the arson of the building. And because that technically an offense against property, not offense against the person, but because it has significant elements about a person and because arson in general, there's not, according to the Department of Law, what they told me was that they don't see lots of arson prosecutions, but the arson prosecutions, because they tend to involve fire and explosion, tend to have a pretty high degree of dangerousness at all levels. And that's the reason why arson was added.
Yes, Senator Tobin.
Thank you. And I noticed in the bill it says any degree. So I'm assuming first degree is one that potentially impacts life. And then the other degrees may just be property or when there is a small dumpster fire. Would those also be included in this for a first offense?
Through the chair, Senator Tobin, as it's currently written, that's correct. Senator Dunbar had talked with me some about looking at whether or not it should only be first-degree arson that's included or whether it should also include second- and third-degree arson. And what I advised him, and I'll say the same thing to you, that that's a question that I think we should take up in the next committee, which is the Judiciary Committee on which you serve.
And if you would like, we can always take an opportunity to hear from Mr. Skidmore. Or his representative, or anyone else in the Department of Law.
Or a Judiciary Committee could do that.
Or the Judiciary Committee can do that. I would always take that opportunity here. Let's just get more. I'm also, she wants to.
Oh.
Good afternoon. For the record, my name is John Skidmore. I'm the Deputy Attorney General for the Criminal Division of the Alaska Department of Law.
Sir,
specific question you want me to answer?
Yes, about arson and the degrees of arson and why the Attorney General feels that should be added.
Alaska Statute 1146-400 is arson in the first degree, and it expressly indicates that the act recklessly places another person in danger of serious physical injury, which is, I think, what you heard Senator Klayman talk about a few moments ago. The other degrees of arson are arson in the second degree, which talks about knowingly damaging a building by starting a fire or causing an explosion. So the dumpster fire would not qualify because that's not a building, but it would have to be a building that's either on fire itself or causing an explosion. Those don't automatically have to place somebody else at risk, but when you talk about arson, setting a building on fire and the risk of other buildings catching on fire or explosions that tend to be those more sort of serious conduct, those are also things that we consider very dangerous. And individuals that you were talking about that have been charged with those crimes and then are found incompetent, though the crime itself in that one instance may not have necessarily resulted in causing harm to someone. For instance, I think of a series of arsons that occurred in the Fairbanks area. In some of those arsons, no one was hurt. In other arsons, there were people hurt. So that's why we start to think about all the degrees of arson in that regard. And arson in the third degree, arson in the second degree is Alaska Statute 1146-410. Arson in the third degree is Alaska Statute 46-420. And that's one that talks about when a person intentionally damages, instead of a building, it's now a motor vehicle by starting a fire or causing an explosion while that vehicle is located on public land, or that the property of another person by starting fire or causing an explosion while that vehicle is located on private property. And so once again, you come back to that concept of while that particular crime is not necessarily one that placed someone at danger, the behavior of intentionally starting fires or getting some sort of joy for starting fires, which is typically what arson is associated with, unless it's insurance fraud, in which case you're trying to burn down the building for other reasons. But in all circumstances, the nature of arson itself, starting those fires, does place others in risk, even if it's not in a specific case where we can prove beyond a reasonable doubt somebody was at risk. That nature of it and the individuals that engage in that conduct tend to be a greater risk to society. Ultimately, that's obviously a policy call that you all in the legislature would have to make about whether or not you think someone that's engaged in that conduct should be someone that's subject to these additional considerations for whether or not they should be civilly committed. Because you're not just talking about someone then that is setting fires, you're talking about someone who's setting fires that has a mental illness, which means they're incompetent to be held responsible, and do you think that person's a risk to be back out in the community for going on to those civil commitments? That's really where the connection starts to come in. So while I appreciate, and I don't think it would be appropriate to apply this to anyone committing a property crime because of the nature of arsons, and because you're talking about somebody with a mental illness setting fires, you have to kind of step back and ask yourself, does that put into a different category?
Yeah, follow up, and then we'll go to Senator Dunbar.
And I may not understand this correctly, so please correct me here. Within the case of an individual who is underage, and they have momentary psychosis, or maybe they have expressed a level of schizophrenia that has gone undiagnosed, and that maybe their family doesn't have access to medical care intervention, how would that interplay with this?
Through the chair, Senator Tobin, when you start to deal with juveniles, those individuals that are under the age of 18 years of age, they're typically in a different justice system, the juvenile justice system, and so the things we're talking about here wouldn't necessarily be applying to them. The only instances in which that would occur would be in the case of arson in the first degree, which is a Class A felony. And the reason that's important is that there is a statute that results in a automatic waiver of a juvenile into adult court when the person is 16 years of age or older and they've committed an A or an unclassified felony. So only in that instance would you be looking at 16 or 17-year-olds that could be moved into adult court because of the seriousness of that crime. That would not apply to those lower levels of arsons because those are not automatic waiverable cases. So I hope that helps.
Senator Dunbar.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just really briefly, and I do hope the Judiciary Committee takes a long look at this. Just what you said, Deputy Attorney General, the first degree is essentially a crime against a person because you know the person is there or you recklessly endanger them. Are you worried at all? First of all, we've talked about this before, but there are other crimes that are extremely dangerous that obviously are not included here. So for arson, the second and third degree, again, I hope that the next committee looks at narrowing this. And my question to you, though, is, you know, obviously we have received some indication that this might result in a lawsuit. This bill as a whole might result in a lawsuit sort of challenging its constitutionality. Do you have any worry that if you expand, so this was a result of a very narrow instance that involved crime against a person, very serious, but pretty unique set of circumstances. Do you have any worry that if you expand to include arson, and not just first-degree arson, but all degrees of arson, that you might make this bill sort of more susceptible to that kind of legal challenge?
Through the chair to Senator Dunbar, I'm not sure what the legal challenge is that folks are contemplating. There's a significant CS that's just been placed in front of the committee today. I haven't even had a chance to finish digesting all of the CS because I've only had it for a few hours. So I can't comment on every section of it, nor can I really comment on a lawsuit that someone may or may not be wanting to bring and why they think it may be appropriate to bring. If you've been hearing about it prior to today, that may be focused on holding someone for 5 years. That wouldn't have anything to do with this section of arson that we're talking about or other issues. And in terms of that 5 years, that's really a suit that's brought in the civil courts. And though I've been a lawyer for over 25 years now, I've exclusively practiced as a prosecutor, so I'm very familiar with criminal law, and I'm happy to discuss that with you. But when you start to get into civil law, I start to harken back to law school, and I suddenly find myself way out of my depth in trying to provide you guidance here today.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Any further questions for any other folks in the room on this bill or for the bill sponsor? Seeing none. I will remove my objection. Is there further objection to adoption of the CS? Seeing none, the CS is before us as our working document. That being said, is there any further conversation or debate to be had on this piece of legislation before us? Well, Senator Coffin.
Just say, I'm looking forward to hearing more around the kind of the due process issues and other things associated with this bill when it comes to judiciary. And I think it'll be great when we've had more time to assess the contents of the CS. And I think judiciary is a great place to do that. So I'm willing to move the bill to judiciary and have that discussion. Thank you.
Yes, I too have some judicial concerns, of which this is not the Judicial Committee, but I believe three of the members here serve on the Judiciary Committee, which will have further conversation of some of the more judicial and constitutional related issues that may come up to this piece of legislation. And so I look forward to hearing those pieces of conversation before we may see this bill before the next committee of referral after that. And I'll take a brief at ease here. We are back on the record. Any further conversation? Seeing none, do we have a motion to move the CS for Senate Bill 53 from committee?
I do. I move CS for Senate Bill 5333-LS0172-S from committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note.
Is there any objection? Seeing and hearing none, The CS for Senate Bill 53 moves from committee. We'll take a brief at ease to sign the document, and we'll prepare for our next piece of legislation, Senate Bill 57. Alright, we are on our last item of business today, Senate Bill 57, the Adult Home Care Med Assistant, sponsored by Senate Rules Committee by request of the Governor. At the table, we have Acting Director Tony Newman, the director, the Acting Director of for that Division of Senior Disability Services from the Department of Health. We heard an overview of this bill, took a sectional and invited in public testimony on March 2nd. Are there any final questions for the bill sponsor at this time? Does the bill sponsor have any words or comments that they would like to make?
Thank you, Senator Wilson. This is Tony Newman. I am the Acting Director of the Division of Senior Disability Services. Just that Senate Bill 57 provides elderly Alaskans and Alaskans with disabilities with another option for living and receiving services beyond what we're able to offer now. And we did receive many positive comments through public testimony. We're grateful for all of those who came forward to testify and look forward to continuing to work with the legislature on this legislation.
Thank you. We did not receive any amendments to this bill. Are there any amendments at this time? Seeing none, is there a motion to move this bill from committee? Senator Kaufman.
We have a motion. I move Senate Bill 57, 33-GS1708/A from committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note.
Is there any objection? Seeing none, Senate Bill 57 moves from committee. We'll take another brief at ease on the paperwork. Thank you, Director Newman. Ends our business for today. Are there any closing comments from committee members? Seeing none, on Tuesday we'll hold our confirmation hearing for Commissioner Designee Kim Koval for the Department of Family and Community Services, and also take public testimony for the designee at that time as well. We are adjourned at 4:07 p.m.